what would happen in, you know, a potential conflict where you have the Chinese that have been able to penetrate our defense supply chain and primarily our software supply chain. But it's not far-fetched to think that the Chinese have penetrated our supply chain to such a degree that we don't know what is actually on the chips or in the firmware of what is flying off of our aircraft carriers.
We'll get into a little bit of the details surrounding that book, as well as the prospect of cyber warfare. But before we do all that, Mike, if you wouldn't mind, give us a little bit of your background from your time at US Cybercom and kind of what you did and how you discovered some of these problems.
And again, I appreciate you having us on. So my background, I spent 12 and a half years in the Navy as an active duty intelligence officer, primarily focused on counterintelligence and human intelligence. Deployed all over the world. The last 6 years, I was at U.S. Cyber Command, where I was the senior counterintelligence advisor, and I was the chief of counterintelligence and human intelligence for the Cyber National Mission Force. While I was there, I did all sorts of things, but I think my one I'm most proud of was supporting the hunt teams that went forward and cleaned out the Ukrainian networks ahead of the Russian invasion in 2022, and supporting the Ukrainian intelligence services, but also their critical infrastructure. That was something that was really important to me. And looking back, one of the things that I was most proud of. That experience, getting to see really all facets of the cyber war, so to speak, which Bill and I will talk about in a little bit, but we look at what's going on in cyberspace as an ongoing war. It's a battle, and anybody who connects to the internet is part of that battle, is part of that battlefield. And that's where the name of the book, Battlefield Cyber, comes from. I worked a lot with the interagency. I worked obviously with the Department of Defense, but also with the FBI, with various elements of the law enforcement community, and different elements of the intelligence community as well, as we were looking at this problem. And what became very clear was there is a distinct line between the federal government and the private sector that desperately needs to be bridged. And there has been a lot of efforts to do that of late, but there's still a lot more to do. And so part of this book is trying to be a clarion call that everybody has a part to play in the ongoing, ongoing battle and in cybersecurity. And we need folks on the government side, we need folks on the private side, but more importantly, we need the private sector and the public sector to come together.
Yeah, so it sounds like you're watching some of the cyber warfare being carried out in Ukraine over the past almost decade now. And you start seeing a lot of similarities between things that are happening there and things that could happen here. It sounds like there's a lot of systemic risk, especially in the private sector, as some of those incentives aren't always there for companies to spend the money on cybersecurity. Can you give a little bit of insight into some of the risks you're seeing in the private sector and how that's different from the risks in the government sector?
Yeah, certainly. And so, and I kind of left this part out, but I'm also, so now that I've left government, I'm a cybersecurity attorney in DC. And in wearing that hat, I focus on doing cyber incident response for companies. And so if you have a company or an organization that gets hit with ransomware, for instance, they call me as their outside counsel. I work very closely with cybersecurity vendors who specialize in doing incident response, interface with the insurance companies, work with negotiators in the case of ransomware, strategic communications professionals to make sure that they're protecting their reputation effectively, and then getting them from the worst day of their life back to business as usual. And that's kind of what I focus on. What that's done is it's given me the opportunity to see things not from the government side, but from the private sector side. And the interesting aspect of that, and my biggest takeaway and the difference, is that from the government side, everyone is looking at, you know, we have national security interests. We need to safeguard and protect what it is that our networks. We need to safeguard our critical infrastructure. On the private sector side, you have companies that are looking at it from their interests. And rightfully so. They need to make sure that they are staying solvent. They have fiduciary responsibilities to their shareholders, to their boards, or responsibilities to their boards, responsibilities to their customers or their constituents. And what the private sector is looking at is ensuring that they are able to get back to business as fast as possible. The public sector and the government is trying to impose a lot of requirements, whether they're reporting requirements, baseline cybersecurity requirements, hygiene, or similar requirements. And the private sector is doing its best to make sure they're complying. the problem that you kind of run into is that that incentive structure, it only works if the private sector is gleaning some benefit from doing what it is.
Take it up from there.
So the
conversation that goes on in the boardroom with between senior management and the board is not one of how do we secure our data? How do we prevent anyone from getting into our systems? The conversation is about how do we limit the liability to ourselves and to our company if and when we assume someone's going to get in, someone's going to steal some data, someone's going to release it, someone's going to compromise it somehow. So it's sort of a given assumption in the boardroom. And the idea is that it's probably cheaper to hire cyber attorneys and one of the big cybersecurity companies and lay off the risk on the insurance companies and get it set up so that when the bad things happen, the CEO of the company doesn't lose his job, the boards are not sued, and so it's a defensive mentality. It's not one of let's go out and fix this problem before it happens. Let's minimize the cost to ourselves after it happens.
And in large part, what the government is putting forth with these requirements are minimum compliance standards, which inherently you're going to have companies that are going to adhere to those minimum requirements. They're going to spend just enough to make sure that they are in compliance, but not a dollar more unless it's in their best interest. And so from an incentive structure standpoint, there's a happy medium that we need to find where companies are incentivized to do more than just the bare minimum, but they're incentivized to have the full cybersecurity suite, the tools that are going to make them hard targets for adversaries or for malicious cyber actors above and beyond just the baseline. And those types of incentive structures, it's really difficult for the government to do that unilaterally. And so there are other options and things that we've explored and we talk about in the book, like using insurance, for instance, and working through insurance companies to have make it so that premiums are reduced or that coverage is more easily attainable if you do certain things. And at this point, insurance is a tool, but it's a tool that we don't think has been used very effectively, at least not by the government.
Yeah, one thing that I've thought about with insurance, which I guess in the past we've seen cyber insurance actually take quite a bit of losses early on, and they didn't have great underwriting practices. But one thing, maybe similar to health insurance, which I'm not going to say is a gold standard, but they're very good about incentivizing preventative care. Whereas you don't see quite as much of that. Like, for example, if insurance was to say they'll cover a pen test every year, but they'll cover, you know, some sort of security assessment.
Yeah, and you know, the example I like to use in this is if you look at any modern building, and really any building built post 1980 something, and you look at the ceiling, you're going to see fire extinguishers. You're going to see the water system that's there. Well, why do we have those? It's part of its code, yes, but the reason those were originally implemented had nothing to do with code. It was because insurance companies said, we're not going to find this building to be insurable unless there are fire systems in here, unless there are fire extinguishers. And so engineers, architects, builders, they began putting in fire systems. But that was an insurance-driven mechanism to make buildings more safe, more secure. The reason being is because if you have a fire system in your fire extinguisher system in your building, it's much less likely to burn down to have a full catastrophic recovery that the insurance would then have to bear. And so something similar can be put in place for cybersecurity. It just that you have to have the right incentives. And at this point, insurance is still trying to wrap their head around how do you effectively cover cyber incidents? Everything from a nation state type incident like NotPetya to ransomware like Colonial Pipeline, all the way down to the run of the mill, and I say run of the mill, but traditional cybercrime or ransomware that's purely for financial gain.
Yeah, we got a little bit of taste, I think, of what cyber warfare would look like when the Colonial Pipeline incident happened. And imagine it would be something like that, but multiplied by quite a bit more.
We have to assume that Chinese and Russians have inserted malware into much of our critical infrastructure, and of course our intelligence agencies have some malware inserted into their infrastructures as well. But the smart money is that if they decided to throw the switch, they could have an impact on our financial system, on our food systems, on our energy, on our electricity. I mean, they could create havoc overnight. Now it's like the version of mutually assured warfare, mutually assured destruction, that we don't know what American agencies could do in those countries, but it would be a devastating, and it's already in place. I mean, we're playing with real fire here.
Yeah, you know, it seems like to give like a battlefield analogy, it would kind of be like if we were being invaded and everyone just hunkered down their house and defended their house, but has let the enemy walk around and continue moving. That kind of seems like how the incentives are right now. Companies will take their own security seriously to a certain degree, depending on the company, if they're in a regulated industry. But that does leave open a lot of systemic risk. I mean, you can see like with denial of service attacks, the FTC has had to really start cracking down on a lot of home IoT devices as they were being used for denial of service.
So, yeah, I would say some of the systemic risk we have is what Bill and I have described as consolidation of a few major and key players in the internet. The biggest issue, I mean, and we see this, I think, most notably in cloud service providers. There are a small number of cloud service providers that the vast majority of companies are utilizing, and that's, you know, AWS, Microsoft Azure, Oracle. But we're moving towards this, this model where you have a few very large providers of cloud services, which in some degree, or the argument for it is that, well, yeah, if you put a lot of money behind cloud services and we offload our security to these very large companies, surely their security is going to be better because they can put more money towards securing that environment than an individual mom and pop manufacturer or store would be able to. And so rather than hire a CISO and have to go out and get all of these cybersecurity services and work with different vendors, instead companies are saying, well, I can just offload that. I can store my data. I can store my customers' data in the cloud. Again, it's not unreasonable to assume that. The problem is that we're creating effectively single points of failure. And so because it's not just the mom and pops, it's not just companies or nonprofit organizations. We also have the federal government that's utilizing AWS, Oracle, and Microsoft. One of the biggest contracts the DoD has ever given was recently given out, and it was something to the tune of $10 billion to Oracle, Microsoft, Google, and AWS for cloud services. And again, that's the idea is that we want it to be these big companies that are reliable, that have good services. But if they go down or if they're targeted, that suddenly takes out not just, you know, a few companies, a few organizations in a given geographic area. Suddenly you're talking about our federal government, our critical infrastructure, all of our companies, because they're all reliant on these individual, this small number of very large and concentrated cloud providers. So because we're concentrating it, because we're creating almost a monopoly on cloud services, I think we're creating the incentive. We're disincentivizing small.
We're actually creating more inviting targets for the Chinese and Russians.
Yeah, and we're disincentivizing other cloud service providers who might be innovative, who might have other solutions or ways to do it more securely, ways to encrypt the data, ways to ensure that you don't have you're not able to exploit the cloud environments, whether it's public, private, or hybrid. And as a result, we're basically setting ourselves up to be stuck with the big four and no one else. And that, so that's a single target that we're then creating for our adversaries.
The key issue is cross-tenant vulnerabilities. So if the Chinese can get into one of these big cloud systems and figure out a vulnerability that allows them to get into one client company, the chances
like
the are... What's that?
Like in the hypervisor.
Right. So the Chinese have demonstrated that they can get inside these systems and live there for years. The average, I mean, 3-4 years is not unusual for one of these advanced persistent threat groups from China. And so they wait patiently and can monitor, encrypt the data, exfiltrate the data, penetrate the decision-making systems of the entities they're most interested in, and then evaporate. If when they get tired of being there and playing in that sandbox, then they can disappear. When IBM was one of the cases, one of the companies that was penetrated in APT 10 back in 2018. And so the feds revealed that the Chinese had been inside and been in 10 or 12 different industries and had downloaded incredible amounts of information. IBM was told the Wall Street Journal, we didn't see any sign of illicit activity in our systems. They couldn't see it. IBM could not see it. So that's what's happening, is that the Chinese have become very sophisticated in terms of penetrating our cloud computing as well as our software supply chains.
Yeah, I mean they're incredibly good at what they do. We've seen that over and over from some of the high profile breaches, as well as some of the intellectual property theft and everything that they do. And what it seems like, even if just, say, like US East, AWS, US East went down, that would be catastrophic to think about. We've switched to such a software as a service economy. Even if everything was still backed up in the US West, now you have at least double the traffic now flowing to that one, which could potentially overwhelm US West as well if that were to happen. Even if just like one major software service provider, like Salesforce went down, that's caused extreme economic damage. It seems kind of like this could be leading to kind of like a Pearl Harbor type moment where we have all of our assets in one spot.
We don't think our adversaries want to crash us. We think that their goal is to use these attacks to create doubt in the mind of Americans about the viability of their own institutions. We think they are using social media to fuel some of the partisan culture wars kind of issues. We think they're trying to infiltrate and understand our decision-making processes. So the idea that they want to have one Pearl Harbor, that would galvanize us. That would really piss us off, right? We might actually start getting serious about taking care of some of these underlying problems. But as long as they can incrementalize it and extract money from us in ransomware and gradually undermine us, that's really, we think, the strategy. It's not to have one Pearl Harbor.
Yeah, and Bill hit the nail on the head. What we've seen is our adversaries are coming at us in a way that's below the level of armed conflict, and this is intentional. Russia and China do things very differently, and the Russians are very, you know, bombastic, very in your face about what they're doing. They're willing to go where others are not. And we saw that in 2016 with the targeting our presidential election. We saw it using the release of NotPetya in 2017 in Ukraine. But they're willing to conduct these destructive attacks using cyberspace. They're willing to undermine our democratic institutions using cyber tools, using social engineering. The Chinese do it a little bit differently. The Chinese are more focused on targeted espionage. They're focused on the long game. They're focused on utilizing cyberspace to advance their military, political, and economic goals all at once. But that's not to say that the Chinese don't have the same capabilities, if not much better, than what the Russians do. The Chinese are just not willing to use them in a similar way. And so if we're waiting for this Pearl Harbor moment, I mean, quite frankly, it's already happened. And it's happened time and time again. And you look at the elections, the election interference, the targeting of the DNC and the DCCC through candidate and Secretary Clinton's campaign manager. We saw it with the Russians during SolarWinds. We saw it with the Chinese targeting Microsoft Exchange. We just saw it with the Chinese in Volt Typhoon, where they were targeting our naval infrastructure and our telecommunications critical infrastructure in Guam and in continental U.S. And so these major events that continue to happen, we're almost becoming numb to. And so if we're waiting for some major event, that major event is literally going to be something to the effect of all of the lights go out on the East Coast. And if that's what we're waiting for to galvanize us to action, we are in a very, very bad place. In reality, we need to look at this as, hey, these incremental events, each one of them in the aggregate, this is worse than Pearl Harbor. We have been targeted time and time again. Our political structure, our democracy, our national security is being undermined on a regular basis. Our economics, our innovation, our industry is being undermined on a daily basis. Yet we continue to have political infighting, and we continue to have fighting amongst our private sector and public sector instead of coming together in the way we did, really, that we haven't since World War II. to have to mobilize our industrial base, to mobilize our cybersecurity ecosystem in a way that actually safeguards this country.
Tom, the Chinese don't necessarily believe in having a kinetic war, or having a physical war. They that's obviously very destructive. They have 5,000 years of history with conflict. They will do a lot of things to avoid having a war. So one of the things they did, as Mike just mentioned, was this Volt Typhoon. They were seeking to penetrate the Navy's communications in the Pacific Ocean so that in the event of an incident, they could disrupt the Navy's ability to communicate with their ships. I mean, that's how audacious they've been. The other thing they've done that's incredibly audacious is that the 300,000 companies in the defense industrial base have prevented the Pentagon from auditing their systems. So, but the Chinese are in there. The Chinese have stolen the designs for the C-17, for the Gerald R. Ford air-class carrier at that level. They launched the Fujian aircraft carrier. On and on it goes. They've stolen the designs for supersonic missiles that we were designing to launch from our submarines. They've stolen so much military technology that the American military is looking at an adversary now that's armed with stolen American technology. They're a peer competitor because over the course of 20 years, they've stolen what the American military has. Mike, tell them the story about what could happen if there was a conflict between our planes and their planes, and we pull the trigger and it doesn't go off. But
we used a fictional account in the part of the book. We used the fictional account to explain what would happen in a potential conflict where you have the Chinese that have been able to penetrate our defense supply chain and primarily our software supply chain. But it's not far-fetched to think that the Chinese have penetrated our supply chain to such a degree that we don't know what is actually on the chips or in the firmware of what is flying off of our aircraft carriers. And so in the fictional account, what we talked about is there's a real possibility that the Chinese have actually hard-coded into the motherboards of certain circuitry or certain chips that are on that we're using for very specific things in our aircraft, such as launching missiles, like such as being able to launch our air-to-air missiles in defense, or being able to launch our ballistic missiles as part of our strategic nuclear defense. But if you have something like that and it's hard-coded or it's in the firmware, it's in on the chips themselves, that is a receiver for electronic warfare, and you cross a certain line, like let's say we have ships that are going through the Strait of Taiwan, and the Chinese just want to shut down all of our communications or prevent us from being able to launch any sort of weapons, any of our missiles, any of our aircraft. Using electronic warfare, theoretically, if they have already changed the coding of the chips, you could have electronic warfare be sending up a signal that is effectively a kill switch for all of our military technology. And we don't really know if that's the case because we haven't been able to do a full and effective audit of our supply chain, whether it's our software supply chain, our firmware supply chain. And so we have aircraft, we have ships, we have submarines that are out in operations right now that very well could be completely compromised by the Chinese. And we won't know until the proverbial balloon goes up and we are in a hot war. When we go to pull the trigger on a missile and it doesn't fire. And it doesn't fire because the Chinese have remotely disabled it because they penetrated the supply chain back in 2010.
So do you think any of that is related? They recently had that spy balloon, which went over U.S. military installations in country. Do you think any of that is related to that as far as the electronic warfare aspect of it?
It's a good question, and I don't want to rule anything out. And my information comes from what's in open source. I think it's interesting the path that the balloon took. I think if you map where it went and over the strategic installations that we have, I think it's interesting. I think the ability to collect signals intelligence from a balloon, from an asset like that, is pretty significant and pretty substantial. I think the fact that they were brazen enough to do it, and we've seen it happen over Hawaii, but to do it over the main, like the continental United States and the entire you know, width of the continental United States, thinking that there would be no ramifications or thinking that that's something that they could get away with. I mean, that's pretty brazen. What does that mean for the future? And that's really where what it comes down to. Are they going to do, will there be another balloon? Probably not. But the question is, what do they collect and what do they actually get from that? And was it the signals that were coming off of, you know, they flew over NORAD, NORTHCOM. Were they getting the strategic communications and are they going to be able to break those communications? Were they able to obtain targeting information that they could potentially use in the event of a hot war? Not necessarily for a kinetic strike or a ballistic missile strike, but something just to the effect of an EMP, a strategically placed EMP that, because they know the strength of the signals that are coming off of our military bases, if you have an EMP or if you have a very targeted, tailored cyber operation, can you shut down our ability to communicate? Can you disable our command and control? And I think the answer to that, I mean, if you have enough information, which theoretically, if you have a balloon traveling directly overhead that's able to suck up those signals, you can probably reverse engineer exactly how we're communicating and exactly what frequencies we're using, to the degree that you're able to target those frequencies. You're able to jam them using electronic warfare. You're able to target it with an EMP to disable it, or you're able to use a tailored cyber operation to disrupt our command and control.
The Chinese are masters at studying our systems and how we work. And one of the vulnerabilities they exploited using the balloon was that our planners have not been very focused on near space. We're focused on up to 40, 50 or 60,000 feet, and then it skips to the satellites that are several hundred miles up. So they recognize, their theoreticians, their military theoreticians recognize the Americans were not spending much focus or attention on this near space concept. So they said, well, this is an obvious opportunity for us. And it was. So, I mean, that's the genius level of thinking and strategizing the Chinese are capable of. They understand how we're structured, how we communicate, and then they pick it apart.
Yeah. So it seems like there's two different, I guess, objectives of their cyber campaigns. It seems like one is kind of death by a thousand paper cuts. And then it seems like the other is potentially, especially when you saw like the Volt Typhoon, it seemed like it was potentially preparing for war.
The Chinese invented death by 10,000 cuts. That's one of their unique contributions to human culture, is a form of torture called death by 10,000 cuts. They're very gradual. They don't want to do it all overnight. They've set a goal by 2049 of having the world's most powerful military. That's 100 years after Mao Zedong secured victory in 1949. So they're thinking in terms of decades and centuries, whereas we in this country are focused on quarterly earnings and the next political cycle. So they are thinking for the very long term, to gradually erode our capabilities, not to engage in any kind of sudden sucker punch.
So how do we change the incentives? It seems like you can either respond in kind to what they're doing, which isn't a particularly attractive option, or you can convince the private sector to spend quite a bit more money on security, which will eventually add to inflation and the costs will get passed on to the customers.
Yeah, I think.
Go ahead, Mike.
I think there's a question in there that needs to be asked, and the question is: do you believe that we are at war? And a lot of people, I actually asked this question today during a panel discussion, and it was: if you believe we're at war, then what? What does that mean? And what does that unlock for us? Well, from a political perspective and from an authority's perspective, it unlocks a lot of things. It unlocks the opportunity for the president to use the Defense Production Act to force corporations to act in a certain way or to do things, because that's part of the emergency powers that are granted to the executive branch. And so if we are at war in cyberspace, not the traditional term of war, but if we consider this to be an emergency then the president is authorized to require that companies do certain things. Now, if you say that in a boardroom, you're gonna scare a lot of people. You're gonna have a lot of CEOs that say, "Well, the president can't tell me what to do. This isn't World War II.
This is the private sector, right?
Yeah, it's the private sector, and it's up to us. In reality, that is something that I think the government, from time to time, should probably remind the private sector of. And that if we allow it to get to a certain point, and if we allow it to become an existential threat, that everyone in this country, every corporation in this country, is subject to the Defense Production Act, and the president can mandate certain things of them. And some of those things are mandating compulsory censoring of their networks, compulsory reporting of cyber incidents and events on their network, anomalous activity. But those types of things that we should be doing anyway, not necessarily the government putting sensors or monitors on networks. I think that's a bridge too far. But certainly threat information sharing, threat intelligence sharing. If you have a company that's hit by a unique or exquisite form of malware, something we haven't seen before, that company shouldn't be permitted to hide that from the rest of its industry, particularly if it's in critical infrastructure, but also shouldn't be permitted to hide that from the government, because that doesn't help anyone. If the Chinese are in, you know, Microsoft Exchange, or the Russians, when they got into SolarWinds and modified the Orion software, that's something that needs to be shared immediately with the government. For SolarWinds, Mandiant did exactly that. And so when that occurred, Mandiant was immediate and reported it everywhere that they needed to. But that type of thing is not typical. Most companies, most boards, most directors and officers of companies don't allow for it to be reported to the government right away, because they're concerned about their bottom line. They're concerned about their shareholders. And I understand that. They have that fiduciary responsibility. But at a certain point, we also need to take into account national security concerns, and we need to start acting as a country rather than in the interests of corporations.
The other problem is that our government is not really organized well to respond to the digital offensive coming across so many different avenues. So, for example, if a company has a cyber incident, is attacked, they don't necessarily know, should they report it to CISA, the Cybersecurity Infrastructure Security Agency within Department of Homeland Security? Should they report it to the FBI? Who reports what to whom? And our government is not organized to respond to the digital era. For example, one of the absolutely crazy examples is that the NIST, the National Institute of Standards and Technology within Department of Commerce, collects known vulnerabilities from a variety of different sources and publishes them on a regular basis. Their hope is that companies that issue the software will issue patches, and that their customers will then apply the patches. So this is public information. That's public. So guess what? The Ministry of State Security of China's CIA, according to the FBI and CISA, they routinely monitor the list of routine of known vulnerabilities, and they pay visits. Unquestionably, they pay visits to those companies with those vulnerabilities before they can get patched. So they're able to seed back doors, Trojans, rats, whatever you want to call them, into companies throughout our economy. So and we're telling them how to do it. And that's just one of the craziest things that's going on. So we need NIST within Commerce to be part of the CISA, which is now Department of Homeland Security, as Mike so well. We need a Department of Digital Security that combines all these functions so that we know what we're doing, and the private sector knows where to go to report these problems. And so the government is just not focused, not organized right now to manage these issues.
Yeah, I mean, it seems like for the most part, a lot of the breach disclosure is handled by states and sometimes local municipalities. That's usually only if it's exposing people's information. But say they came in and like stole intellectual property, you may not have to disclose that at all. I think with the exception if you're an SEC regulated company, they have some requirements. But on the other hand, if you look at China, all the companies there are required to disclose any vulnerabilities. They're required to disclose any security breaches, and they're also required to cooperate for any sort of espionage or national intelligence.
They have a system set up where no vulnerabilities, 0 days, and other things that are discovered are fed into the government by law. Not that the Communist Party needs laws to enforce its will, but the vulnerabilities and these 0 days are fed into the government's apparatus. So and so they have a whole national infrastructure focused on identifying vulnerabilities and exploiting them.
Yeah, I think that's a key point. And I think that's something that's at least worth digging into here. The dichotomy between the U.S. and China when it comes to cybersecurity writ large, but also when it comes to information sharing and the ability for the government to compel companies or individuals to do something, is could not be on farther ends of the spectrum. So in the U.S., when it comes to breach reporting, and Tom, you're right, the part of what breach reporting requirements are you have to go to the individual state from whom of which the individual whose data has been impacted or has been breached, that's who you have to report it to. And so various states have different requirements. And so if you're in, each one has different numbers. If you're in California, I think if it affects 1,000 citizens, then that company has to report it to the Attorney General, but you still have to report it to the individuals whose data has been compromised, even if it's just one. In some states, it's if there's been one individual whose data was compromised, you have to report it to the Attorney General of that state. But that's just for individual data. That's for personally identifiable information. We have separate regimes for different types of information, all of which goes to different organizations, whether it's at the state level or at the federal level. And so aside from the individual state notification requirements that either have to go to individuals or have to go to the state attorneys general, you also have HIPAA. And so for protected health information, you have to do a separate report that goes to to HHS OCR. You have to and obviously report it to those individuals, but that could potentially leave what's called a covered entity, a healthcare provider. They could lose their Medicare and Medicaid contracts if they don't have certain cybersecurity hygiene up there, or if they don't do the correct reporting requirements. For the SEC, you're talking about publicly traded companies or broker dealers. You also have NYDFS, which covers down on any New York-based financial institutions. You have critical infrastructure reporting, and for Colonial Pipeline. Colonial Pipeline falls under the Transportation Security Administration because it's a pipeline. And so Colonial Pipeline would have to report through TSA. Other critical infrastructure, it's going directly to CISA. The FBI, you have the Internet Cybercrime Complaint Center, or the IC3, where there's an IC3 reporting requirement for breaches. But all of these different reporting requirements that companies have to go through, this is why you have to have an attorney every time you get breached, because you don't know who you have to go, you know, who you have to report it to. All of that, in large part, is not compulsory unless it's a highly regulated industry or unless it's state-centric. So we don't have an overarching regime. The Chinese, by contrast, they have a series of three laws that began coming into effect in 2015. So you have the National Intelligence Law, you have the National Security Law, and you have the Cybersecurity Law, all of which collectively say that if the government, any element of the Chinese government, goes to a company and requests information, and I say requests in air quotes there, but requests information, the company, the individuals, they don't have a choice but to provide that information. We have warrant processes, we have subpoenas, we have the Wiretap Act, we have the Fourth Amendment, we have all of these protections for our individuals to protect them against the government. China is absolutely opposite. Everything in China is geared towards protecting the party, to protecting the state. And so everything they do, all of their laws, all their practice, it's not for individual companies, it's not for individuals, it's to protect the state. And so we are fighting as a government, whole of government, and that's kind of the big buzzword you hear, against a country that is their entire nation is geared for war against us. And we are just not geared that way. And we haven't been, especially in cyberspace. And that's where we're seeing it really come to the fore. But that's the most pernicious threat, is the fact that we as a nation we're not structured to go against the Chinese.
We haven't even talked about TikTok, which is one of the most incredible tools ever invented. It's positively addictive for our young people. and is a form of cognitive warfare. I like that phrase, cognitive warfare. If you can get them focused on their screens, and then you can take over the minds of every 18-year-old, 17-year-old young man, and they spend enormous amounts of time. And so what they don't understand is that ByteDance is the owner of TikTok and is firmly under the thumb of the Chinese Communist Party. They have access to the data that's collected. So the data, what kind of data? Well, if you're the child of a scientist, the child of a government official, and you're on there, they can collect your biometric data. They can look at how your eyes behave, how your face smile. They can see what you really need. Then they can track your data, look at all the apps on your device, and then every hour they can find out where you are. They ping you every hour. So this is a pernicious, addictive tool that we are having troubles as a nation coming to grips with and getting rid of it. So that shows you how incredibly sophisticated the Chinese are.
Yeah, it seems like, on the other hand, while they have TikTok, I know more so the Russians have been, they've had disinformation campaigns, and they have basically troll farms, as people call them. So it seems like there's also the information warfare aspect of it. But on top of all that, there's not really a whole lot of deterrence. There's really not any deterrence to stop them from doing it. Is that something all that gets discussed as far as policy? Is like, maybe we should respond in kind, should have some sort of deterrence model in place?
Well, I think deterrence and responding in kind are two different things. Responding in kind would mean that we in turn try to conduct these disinformation campaigns or malign influence campaigns to target their entire population, undermine their system. That's not, you know, there are all sorts of examples of where the U.S. has tried to do that in the past in large, you know, all over the world. It never ends well for us. And so trying to do that, I think, is a fool's errand. But from a deterrence perspective, that's a different story. The problem with deterrence is international law. And so international law is effectively a coalition of treaties, right? Or like a grouping of treaties that we have. And it's either you've got treaties between individual countries, treaties between multiple countries, or you have the actual international legal framework as governed by the UN or other frameworks. When it comes to deterrence, like actual military deterrence, there isn't a whole lot that nations are able to do. And Ukraine paints a really good example of this. So you have Russia, which is a sovereign power, invade the territory of another sovereign nation. That is absolutely an act of war. Under the articles of the UN, UN Charter, it's an act of war. Ukraine is legally authorized to use force to defend itself. But here's the kicker. Nobody else is. Nobody else, because Ukraine's not a part of NATO. They are not part of a coalition that said an attack against one is an attack against all. So nobody else can respond to Russia unless Russia attacks a NATO member country or another country, and then that country would be able to come in and respond. So that's why we're kind of fighting with our hands tied behind our back against the Russians in Ukraine. And the Ukrainians are doing a marvelous job defending themselves, but that's a tragic situation. And that because of international law, we're not able to actually stop an ongoing, you know, massacre, genocide, whatever you want to call it, but that act of war. Now you take that and you translate it into cyberspace. There are no rules when it comes to warfare in cyberspace, really. You've got the Talon Manual, Volume 1 and Volume 2, which are the closest we can come to international treaties or international agreements with respect to cyber warfare. But there isn't anything that says if cyber warfare doesn't affect something in the same way that a missile would affect it, it's not an act of war. So espionage, not an act of war, which means SolarWinds was not an act of war. Colonial Pipeline was not executed by a nation state. It was executed by a ransomware group. So that wasn't an act of war. So, and the malicious or the malign influence targeting our elections in 2016, also not an act of war. So at a certain point, we have to look at all of these different things in the aggregate and say, look, the Russians, they went, you know, you have SolarWinds, you have NotPetya, you have the malign influence campaign targeting our democratic processes. You have you know, it, you take it out of cyberspace and you say the poisoning of Skripal with the Novichok nerve agent in England. All of these activities are clearly undermining international order. They're clearly irresponsible acts that are conducted by a nation state. But individually, none of them rise to the level of an armed attack under the UN Charter. So what do? Well, we sanction Russia. Clearly that didn't work because they then just invaded Ukraine. We can continue doing crippling sanctions, but nothing is happening. And so if you really want to have a deterrence, we need to come together and as an international community and say, we're not going to look at events in isolation anymore. We're going to start taking the totality of what a nation state does, its irresponsible acts, whether in the physical space or in cyberspace, and we're going to aggregate them. And if in aggregate, those acts, those effects have the same impact as a kinetic strike or as an armed attack, that will be considered an act of war under international law, and we will be able to respond in whatever way we deem most appropriate. That's the only deterrence that exists. Because otherwise, you're going to continue to have Russia that's going to act as an irresponsible actor, both in the physical space and in cyberspace. You're going to continue to have China, which is conducting industrial espionage to benefit their companies at the detriment of our economy and to the detriment of our military forces. So without some sort of effective deterrence, it's not going to stop.
One other thing, Tom, you wanted to talk about was software, how we approach our software in this country. We often use, there could be millions of lines of code in an app. And so a software developer concentrates on what's unique about his or her product or his or her offering. And we'll go to a repository like GitHub, and there are many of these repositories. And so they'll borrow like log4j, the login code that was penetrated. They'll borrow out of millions of lines of code. Maybe they only write 100,000 or so. Everything else is from open source. So our adversaries have learned how to penetrate those repositories. Those libraries is another phrase that you hear, and either hijack them with fake names or there are many ways to poison these repositories. And so the very way we write our software makes it vulnerable. I mean, this is something we have to face up to as a nation.
Yeah, it seems like the same thing is really happening with a lot of the AI training data, especially a lot of it's pulled from the open internet where anyone can put whatever they want out there. But as we start getting towards the end here, where do you think all this goes from here?
Well, we hope our book will be a galvanizing force. As things stand today, we can't be very hopeful that the Americans will wake up and smell the coffee brewing and start taking action. We hope that our book is shocking enough to people that they will react to it. And the second part of the book, we lay out solutions. We think that's a unique offering that we are coming to the table with. So we're trying to shock people, very smart and intelligent people in the corporate and governmental worlds, and then trying to offer them solutions. And so far, a lot of this discussion has been about the shock and awe. Oh, isn't it terrible what the capabilities are that our opponents have? But there hasn't been much discussion or focused, serious discussion on what do we do? What are the tangible things we can do? So that's what we have brought to this party. We think we like to think that we are, for the first time, providing answers and a credible path.
Yeah, I'm just going to second what Bill said and, you know, drop foot stomp by the book. No, I mean, I think it's important. I think it's important for both the government and the private sector to both come at this with eyes open and recognize that this isn't just the whole of government problem. This is a whole of nation problem. And really, for the first time since World War II, we actually have an existential threat that's facing this nation. And it's one that's continuing to grow, and it's going to continue to impact us. And if we don't want to become a second-rate nation with a military that has been surpassed by the Chinese, then we need to do something about it. And what we need to do is we need to come together as a private sector and as the government. We need to do a better job of safeguarding our intellectual property, our innovation. And we do that by hardening our cybersecurity posture. We do that by implementing certain things that are not just baseline compliance but that are going to go above and beyond, that are things that are actually going to be effective in preventing the Chinese from being able to steal our intellectual property and undermine our democracy.
So where can people find the book and when will it be available?
Great question. So it's right now it's available for pre-order on Amazon and Barnes & Noble, and it's officially going to come out on August 15th.
I'll make sure to include the link in the description of this podcast. And if people want to find you for more insights, where's the best spot? Or maybe you don't want to be found.
Well, Bill and I are both active on LinkedIn, and we respond readily to direct messages or to comments. So feel free to find us there. Otherwise, we'll be starting our book tour with locations to be determined at this point, but we'll be starting our book tour sometime this fall.